Good morning, and welcome to Greater Good Magazine. This is your volunteer programmer, Barbara Felix, from the Sun Sounds of Arizona Studios. The Greater Good Science Center studies the psychology, sociology, and neuroscience of well-being, and teaches skills that foster a thriving, resilient, and compassionate society. And now, some articles from Greater Good. How deciding to donate a kidney saved my own life. Jessica Leahy's act of altruism had a very unexpected benefit. By Jessica Leahy, February 25th, 2026. When I filled out my National Kidney Registry living donation application, I hoped I'd have the opportunity to improve someone else's life. I never dreamed I'd be saving my own. I first considered living kidney donation years ago when my aunt was diagnosed with kidney disease. That was an easy decision. I love her dearly, and I'd give her any part of me if she needed it. Fortunately, she recovered without needing a transplant, but the idea lingered, popping up from time to time. Signs at an intersection near my daughter's high school asked passers-by to register for the National Kidney Registry so a local woman might receive a much-needed donation. I saw a video about a man who walked up and down the side of the road near his home wearing a sandwich board with the message, "Need kidney for wife," and a phone number. On a flight home from a speaking trip, I discovered the documentary Confessions of a Good Samaritan among my seatback viewing options. In the film, director Penny Lane explores the process, psychology, and ethics behind altruistic kidney donation while undergoing the evaluation and surgery herself. Every time kidney donation faded out of my awareness, some sign came along to remind me that just because kidney donation had disappeared from my thoughts, the need for living donors had not. Currently, over 90,000 people are on the transplant list waiting for news of a donor, and for many of them, chronic kidney disease means dialysis, chronic illness, and financial hardship. The final nudge I needed came via my TikTok feed. The algorithm presented me with Chandler Jackson, or at Chandler, the kidney guy. Chandler has kidney disease and makes videos to help others understand what it's like to be a college student with chronic illness. Through his videos, I learned about his onerous daily peritoneal dialysis routine. Sanitize his dorm room and hands, glove up and mask, prime the dialysis machine, attach cartridges and tangles of tubes, and warm three massive bags of dialysis solution. Sanitize hands, glove up, and mask again before attaching the entire contraption to the dialysis port in his abdomen so he can begin the 9-hour process of using that fluid and his own peritoneum as a filtration system for the waste his kidneys can't eliminate. By the time I scrolled through Chandler's feed, I was resolved. I would donate one of my kidneys in 2026. I likely could not donate to Chandler directly due to geographical and biological limitations, but I could gift him a kidney donation voucher that would move him up the transplant list or start a kidney transplant chain on his behalf. My life, in contrast to Chandler's, is much less complicated. I spend most of my time speaking in schools and community organizations about topics from my books: learning, school engagement, substance use prevention, and parenting. When I'm not on the road or writing at my desk, I'm heaving boulders out of my gardens, tending to my bees, or splitting next winter's firewood. Relatively speaking, kidney donation would have a minimal effect on my life. Yes, I would have to endure a fairly intense medical workup culminating in a day of testing at my closest transplant center, about 4 hours away from my home. If I passed that physical and psychological gauntlet, I would undergo laparoscopic surgery under general anesthesia and spend a couple of days in the hospital. Recovery would take about 4 to 8 weeks at home, so some time off of work would be required. Consequently, my speaking agent was one of the first people I told about the potential donation. She shared that she too was intrigued by the idea of donating and promised to reschedule my existing events. If my screening went according to schedule, I might be able to donate during the cold, dark winter in Vermont, recover while knitting by my wood stove, and be ready to get back out into the garden, forest, and bee yard by spring. Filling out the kidney donor registration form was easy. I completed it on my phone in under 10 minutes while waiting for a flight home from a speaking event. A few days later, a nurse navigator from Mass General Brigham in Boston, my closest kidney transplant site, called to discuss altruistic kidney transplantation and take a more detailed medical history. Once she determined I was a viable candidate, she arranged my first battery of blood and urine tests through a local lab and encouraged me to move up some of my preventative medical tests, like my mammogram and colonoscopy. For the first 55 years of my life, my kidneys warranted little more than a passing thought. But once testing began, I thought about them constantly. Are they healthy? Donation worthy? I read that my transplant team would determine which of my kidneys is healthiest and most robust, and I'd keep that one. So will I keep right or left? Should I name them? I already started to think of my kidneys as something shared, something I was caretaking for a stranger, and keeping those two fist-sized organs healthy became a bit of preoccupation. A week later, after I'd had many vials of blood drawn and collected 24 hours worth of my urine in a large orange jug, I drove to my local medical center for my mammogram. I even took a jaunty picture in the changing room mirror to post on my Instagram feed captioned with something happy and encouraging like, "Don't forget to schedule your mammogram, ladies." When the breast care clinic messaged to let me know I'd need a follow-up mammogram and possibly an ultrasound, I wasn't worried. I'd needed them before, and I'd always come to nothing more than an irregular breast tissue density. I showed up at the University of Vermont Breast Care Center for another gown, another waiting room, and another mammogram. I'd always been released after the repeat mammogram. "It's nothing," they'd say, "just some areas of irregular density. Have a great day." So when the team asked me to stay for an ultrasound, concern began to creep in. I masked it by chatting with the ultrasound technician about our kids as she thoroughly scanned my left breast and lymph nodes. The technician sent me to a small consultation room to wait, and as soon as the radiologist entered the room with that concerned yet caring expression on her face, I allowed worry to blossom into full-on panic. I texted my husband, who was seeing patients in his clinic a few floors up, and asked him to come down to the breast center so I could have a level-headed, rational witness to what I now understood was life-changing news. While I waited for Tim, I picked up my cuticles and took stock of the tiny consult room. That's when I noticed the box of tissues placed prominently on the table next to my chair at the ready. When he arrived, I saw Tim notice it too. The radiologist told us I had a mass in my left breast, one that was most certainly invasive due to its irregular, spiculated, or spiky appearance. I'd need a biopsy as soon as possible. Once we knew what we were dealing with, she continued, I could talk with a breast surgeon about my surgical options. No, I wanted to tell her, she misunderstood. This was not supposed to be about me. I was meant to be giving life to someone else, not weighing the mortality benefits of lumpectomy versus mastectomy. 30 years and another ultrasound ago, when we discovered the baby I was carrying had no heartbeat, I remember feeling a similar sense of nonsensical unreality. This is fine, I thought. My baby would be fine without a heart. We'd adjust. Reality, in both cases, comes later. Tim and I hold hands. We talk. We question. We research. In time, I grasp the full implications of the news and my future. I'd be having surgery and those 4 to 8 weeks of recovery, but it would not culminate in the joy of granting someone else a chance at life. I was devastated, both for myself and for the stranger I'd already granted a small claim on my body. And yet, that mammogram, a test I would have not scheduled for at least 6 more months, caught my cancer early. I was eventually diagnosed with invasive lobular breast cancer, a type that can be difficult to spot in its early stages. I did, in fact, have surgery, a bilateral mastectomy with reconstruction, during the cold, dark Vermont winter, and spent much of December and January near my wood stove knitting a very lumpy and misshapen shawl. By the time the ground thaws and the trails dry this spring, I will have healed enough to go trail running, split firewood, and heave giant stones out of my garden. What's more, Chandler received his kidney transplant this winter after all. Someone else stepped up around the same time that I dropped out. She filled out her registration form, went through rigorous medical testing, and successfully donated her kidney. Because her donation was part of a transplant chain, her direct recipient, Anne Chandler Jackson, have a chance at life free from kidney disease. My initial motivation for donating a kidney may have been altruistic, but in a reversal so common it's cliche, I gained everything I'd hoped to give. About the author, Jessica Leahy is the New York Times best-selling author of The Gift of Failure and The Addiction Inoculation. You are listening to Greater Good Magazine, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. How sports can help bridge our differences. Sports fandom just isn't just entertainment. It's one of our most diverse and most consistent shared rituals. By Jason Mangione and Griffin Colazzi, February 6, 2026. This Sunday, more than 1 million Americans will gather for the Super Bowl, arguably the closest thing we have to a shared national ritual. In stadiums, living rooms, and sports bars, millions of Americans with vastly different political beliefs are all watching the same thing. They'll high-five strangers after touchdowns, groan together over blown calls, and generally just have fun watching a game. At a time when the country feels more fractured than ever, this camaraderie among Americans is rare. It's worth paying attention to the parts of American life where people still come together, where, at least for a few hours, they set aside divisions that so often define our politics, because politics couldn't be further from their minds. Sports fandom is one such phenomenon, and one that's baked into the habits of millions of Americans. What's striking is that this sense of connection extends well beyond the game itself. The biggest sports fans tend to be deeply engaged in their communities and civic life, and most open to connecting with people across political divides. Fans don't just set aside political divisions for a few hours every Sunday. They tend not to let these divisions define them at all. Research conducted by More in Common and Fox Sports in June 2025 found that the most dedicated fans, those who follow sports most closely and participate most actively, are also more likely to be registered to vote in local elections, and to follow politics regularly. They are also more likely to give to charity, attend political meetings, donate blood, and contribute to their communities. What's especially notable is that this engagement doesn't come at the cost of openness. In much of American life, the people who are most politically engaged are also the most likely to misunderstand and distrust members of the opposing political party. Typically, the higher the political engagement, the deeper the partisan divide. Sports fans are an exception. Despite their high levels of political participation, the biggest fans are more open to engaging across political differences, not less. And The more invested the fan, the more open they are to connect. Among the most passionate fans, nearly 7 in 10 say that they'd be interested in a conversation with someone who holds opposing views, compared to just 46% of non-fans. And more than 8 in 10 say that they'd be willing to work with someone from across the aisle to improve their community, compared to 65% of non-fans. Crucially, these patterns appear across the political spectrum. Republican and Democratic fans alike have warmer feelings towards members of the opposing political party and are more open to collaboration than their non-fan counterparts. This willingness to connect across divides is unusual in today's political climate, and it points to a broader truth. Sports are more than entertainment. In an era of polarization, it stands out as one of the few large-scale cultural arenas where people of different backgrounds regularly share space, build trust, and find connection. As one respondent said, "I live in a community where following our sports team brings us together, and my parents were just huge on watching it." That spirit of connection matters even more when we consider who shows up most in these spaces. The most dedicated fans are disproportionately men in an era of rising male isolation. Sports fandom offers a place where connection, conversation, and community are already happening. According to Gallup, 25% of American men aged 15 to 34 reported feeling lonely a lot in their day-to-day lives, compared to 18% of women in the same age group and just 15% in peer democratic countries. Men are also less likely than women to turn to friends or family for emotional support and report having fewer close friendships. In this landscape, sports fandom offers a rare pathway for connection. Sports remain one of the most culturally acceptable spaces for emotional expression among men, with 3 in 4 avid fans, male and female alike, agreeing that sports are a healthy way for men to express themselves. Most men don't proactively spend their time thinking about healthy ways to connect. They're more likely to just sit next to a couple of buddies enjoying a game. Sports create the conditions for connection, offering structure, shared interest, and a sense of ease that makes openness feel more natural. And our data suggests sports fans may experience less loneliness. Specifically, fans are more likely to disagree with the statement, "There is no community where I feel a strong sense of belonging." And fans are more likely than non-fans to see sports as a healthy outlet for male expression. While sports fandom may not solve polarization or loneliness on its own, it shows us that there are still spaces where people of different backgrounds show up, engage, and build trust, even if they're just cheering for the same team. If we want to strengthen civic life, we should seriously take the places where Americans are already finding common ground. Sports fandom isn't just entertainment. It's one of our largest, most diverse, and most consistent shared rituals. And that makes it worth noting. understanding, and cherishing as more than just a game. This Sunday's Super Bowl won't fix all that's broken in America, but for a few hours, it may remind more than 1 million Americans that coming together is still possible. About the authors, Chuck Mangione is the U.S. Executive Director at More in Common, a research organization that seeks to understand the forces driving us apart. And Griffin Colazzi is a research fellow at More in Common and a PhD candidate at Northeastern University. You've been listening to Greater Good Magazine, coming to you from Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer programmer, Barbara Felix, thanking you so much for listening today, and I hope that you have a wonderful rest of your day. And now stay tuned for more interesting programming coming your way next from Sun Sounds of Arizona.